folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. I think we got a great show for you today. Mike Costantino is sitting over across.
He is.
From
Mike's right here.
Yeah, it's going to be a good. We're going to talk about the Constitution and the First Amendment. And you hear people, regardless of stripe, regardless of political stripe. I've had guys that know nothing about the Constitution that will tell you to. I'm a strict constitutionalist.
I know.
And of course, that comes with usually a couple of rounds of AK-47. But this is interesting. So we're going to have some fun this morning. We got a guest, don't we?
Yes, we do. And we're going to have a Klaus von Studerheim introduce him. He's an old friend of yours, right? Did I get your
yes.
name right?
Yeah, almost.
Almost. All right. I'm sorry, Klaus. I'm doing my best here. You know?
Well, welcome, folks. We have with as a guest today close friend of mine for many years, Fergus Bordewick, who is a historian and an author and can talk about almost anything involving early America or America at any time. But we're going to focus on the origin of the Constitution today. Right, Fergus?
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Talk a little bit about We often look at the Constitution. In fact, I have a copy of it sitting in front of me. It's as a disembodied document. Tell us a little bit about the process of the creating the Constitution of the United States. What was it like? Was it divine inspiration? Was it cutting deals? What was it like? What was the environment when they created the Constitution of the United States? The social, political,
the amendments, particularly.
Yeah.
Really interested in the amendments.
Well, bear in mind that the Constitutional Convention took place in the summer. Everybody was sweating like a pig in Philadelphia.
They still do.
And essentially the process of writing the Constitution was like making sausage, like politics usually is, which is to say an often frustrating, aggravating process of grudging compromise, soaring ambition that usually fizzled because in politics, nobody gets what he wants. So the Constitution was a compromise document that made nobody really happy. But those who created it were happy that they came away with something rather than nothing, because the Constitution was, of course, Plan B.
And the criticism of the Constitution by the people who were at the convention was ferocious. People thought it wouldn't work. It would destroy the country. They thought it would lead to tyranny. I mean, the exaggerated fears and criticism of the Constitution by the founders who were writing the Constitution is pretty amazing.
What do you mean exaggerated? I just think it took a few extra years. We're there.
Depends on who you were talking to if you were there in Philadelphia,
right.
Of course. Let's take James Madison.
Yeah, we're talking to James Madison, see what he thinks.
Fascinating man. You wouldn't want to sit around and have a beer with him because he wasn't any fun. But he was a very small guy with a whispery, reedy voice. Nobody could ever hear him. But yet he was still regarded as the most brilliant crafter of the ideas that went into the Constitution. And Madison, for example, wanted more for the Constitution than we find in it. But he was willing to compromise to get anything. You have to realize, if you put yourself in the shoes of people there at the convention, they didn't know what the outcome was going to be. Nobody knew what the future was going to be. There was an element of desperation to this process because the Articles of Confederation, that's to say the system that we had, the non-system we had between the Revolutionary War and the Constitutional Convention, fell flat.
So it was something new in the universe,
yeah.
Right? Or at least in the world. It was a new document. They were on the leading edge of doing something very different than ever been done before.
Well, and they had a country that they didn't know was going to succeed, right?
They didn't know at all. There were pervasive fears with a basis to them that these 13 barely linked states were going to fly apart, that the threats posed from every direction, from the British in the north, the Spanish in the west, and so on, would peel off parts of these embryonic United States. The country was deep in debt. The United States was sort of a broken down third world economy of its day. States, most of them, not all of them, refused to pay their war debts. The states couldn't borrow. This was a desperate problem. Alexander Hamilton was the one who was.
What was the population of the U.S. then?
I believe it was 13 million, but I'm not going to go to the mat on the population.
But a huge city like New York was what, 30, 40,000 people?
New York was 30,000 in 1790. Philadelphia was more populous, 40,000, and Boston was an overgrown small town.
Yeah, and these are small cities by current standards. They would barely register. But these were the heart of all this stuff. Boston, Philadelphia, and New York were a lot of the Constitution be created. We also have to focus on the South and the compromises to keep the South in. And some of the deepest questions about the Constitution have to do with the calculating of slaves as being voters to a certain percentage. How did this happen?
Okay, well, you could say, and I think from our present-day perspective, the most opprobrious compromise of the Constitution was the fact of its tolerance of slavery. The word slavery is never mentioned in the Constitution. Circumlocutions are used to talk around it. But it was perfectly obvious that the Constitution could not be crafted, a single country could not be created without accommodating slavery, which was the core of the economy in all the southern states. But bear in mind that slavery was legal in every state except Massachusetts. New York, the number of slaves in New York State increased in the 1790s, as a matter of fact, although it is true that all the northern states liquidated slavery by the early 19th century. So the tolerance of slavery was, if not universal, it was pretty widespread.
But there were oppositions like Quakers and liberal progressives and sort of individualists in different places who were against slavery very early in the bit. And what was it? England began to abolish slavery before the U.S. And so you had a process of it unwinding. But when they're doing the Constitution, they have to compromise. Is that what you're saying? With southern slave-owning states, which were very wealthy and actually had large population.
The largest state in the Union was Virginia. By far. Virginia and New York came in, I believe, third or fourth at the time. I don't think there were many people who would fit today's definition of liberal, frankly. The configuration of politics was pretty different in the 1780s and 1790s than it is today. Quakers, were the first organized group in the United States to oppose slavery and to begin to lobby against it. The very first lobbying campaign in American history was carried out by Quakers in the first Congress in 1790. And they literally stood in the lobby of Federal Hall in New York, grabbing the lapels of members of Congress to try to get them to legislate against slavery. It went nowhere. It was a fizzle. They didn't swing any political weight.
So there's the Constitutional Convention, but then after the Constitutional Convention, there's the first Congress, the first meeting of the Congress of the United States. What was that like? How did that connect up to the previous thing? Big success?
And that's where the amendments were actually passed.
Yeah, that's correct. The Articles of Confederation, as I said a few minutes ago, were the form of government that this embryonic kind of ramshackle United States attempted to function with in the 1780s. It completely broke down. There were, I believe, 52 different kinds of currency in use in the United States. Mm. You had to change money at a state line. Thomas Jefferson traveling from Virginia to New York for the first time.
Stop for a minute. As a former economist type, 52 currencies, so there had to have been several currencies in each state. How did that work?
Lots of foreign currency was in circulation from different countries, plus different state currencies, plus local issued currencies. Thomas Jefferson had to change money at each state line en route to New York, and he complains in his letters that he got skinned every time. Pennsylvania money could only be used at a deep discount in Virginia, and Massachusetts at a deep discount in Philadelphia.
So establishing a United States unified universal currency for our country was a big deal. When that happened, was it a gradual process, or?
Well, we didn't have a unified currency until the Civil War, actually.
Wow.
Eliminating these border controls, so to speak, was a big deal. In fact, but you asked about the first Congress and how did that fit in here? Yeah. Well, the Articles of Confederation had broken down. The proto-Congress that existed during that period, nobody was showing up. Just nobody showed up. You have John Jay, one of the founders, running around the streets in New York, literally trying to find members to come in to get a quorum and failing. And there was a tremendous anxiety when the first Congress met in 1789 in New York, which was their first capital.
Sure.
In New York, tremendous anxiety that not enough people would show up and there wouldn't be any government at all. So they didn't. There was no great confidence that this was the solution.
But they show up and they hammer this out. They hammer out at least the core of the Constitution, and then they start deciding that they needed certain guarantees. And these are, for a lot of us anyway, the most interesting part. Let's talk about the amendments.
Okay. Bear in mind, the amendments were crafted in the first Congress, not the Constitutional Convention, of course. The Constitution provided a provision for amendment. The Constitution was designed by people we call federalists, and most
believed in a strong central government.
A strong central government, and James Madison wanted a stronger one.
Yeah.
He wanted, for example, and imagine this, he wanted the federal government to be able to enforce its laws within the states, which it could not. Yeah. We didn't have the federal government didn't begin to have that power until the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments. Madison failed to get that in the Constitution. But, okay, so...
So we were so afraid of authoritarianism, we were so afraid of monarchy, that we wouldn't let the federal government enforce laws within the states.
That's pretty much true. There were very, very few federal crimes at the time. They mostly had to do with maritime law. Mm-hmm. There was a tremendous battle over... the powers of federal courts, which were created at the first Congress. They didn't exist before that. And there was a...
The Constitution provides for a Supreme Court and stuff, but they weren't actually created until the Congress after the Constitutional Convention.
The Constitution is just a piece of paper. That's all it is. It's a piece of paper. It isn't a government. It's a set of ideas for a government. And everything... all the machinery of government was created by Congress in that first Congress. And by the way, Congress itself, not the president, was the main center of power at the time. The presidency was comparatively weak. And Madison and others worried more than anything about how they could put some power into the presidency. There'd never been a president. The executive was not strong and was not expected to deliver an agenda for Congress.
Well, put a bookmark there for a second, because I believe this con man that we have now is showing us the powers of the executive branch more so than anybody has since the writing of the Constitution. He's showing us the power, what the president can do as that branch of government. He is laughing at Congress. He is laughing at the founders of the Constitution, because Congress, my butt, it all lies here, baby.
Well, that's a pretty accurate description of the men in the White House. Whether he's as successful as all that in actually getting what he wants is another question, because he has no understanding of or interest in process.
So how did we go from
he's
what
okay
was he,
for a guy with a lack of understanding?
How did we go from 30 proposed amendments or 40 proposed per minute or 50 proposed per minute to the amendments that we actually ended up with?
212 proposed amendments.
212 proposed amendments to the Constitution in the first Congress.
Yeah. The reason there were amendments proposed was that the anti-federalists, that's all those folks out there who hated the Constitution, they thought it was a bad idea, it concentrated too much power, it abridged states' rights. You heard the same states' rights arguments in 1790 that you hear in 1860 and that you hear in some quarters today.
Absolutely.
So the reaction against the Constitution had really set in after it had been crafted. And there was pressure in Congress to deal with this call it an uprising. One of the most hostile people to the Constitution was Patrick Henry, who we count as one of the great founders, but he hated it.
Anything that encroached on liberty, which is what the Constitution did. So tell us what's good about the Constitution, if there is any.
It works. It works. The founders crafted this plan, because it's a plan. It is not the government.
Right.
It's a plan. They crafted a plan which has accommodated the needs of the country politically. Find fault with it, if you will, but there are faults to be found. Okay.
The amendments. What's the process? We've got all these amendments out there. A lot of them are for people who absolutely hate the Constitution. They want to destroy the Constitution. They want to modify it so that it doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
So we have those guys. What else is going on?
Okay. Well, most of those amendments, one way or another, wanted to gut the power of the federal government. Okay. Fortunately, the individual who wound up in charge of organizing the amendments into legislation was James Madison. Why James Madison? Because he was the most influential figure in the writing of the Constitution and was regarded by everyone as the most knowledgeable. And James Madison, today he would have been condemned probably as an incorrigible flip-flopper. That's to say he initially opposed any amendments whatsoever. He thought the Constitution was too fragile. Don't tamper with it. Leave it alone. Let's see if it works before we start reinventing it. But then, campaigning for office as a congressman in Northern Virginia in a highly anti-federalist district, said, well, actually, he was for amendments. And then once he had been elected and was responsible for turning amendments into some legislation, it turned out, well, he wasn't so much for them after all. And only those that wouldn't cause any damage. It's a reasonable position. James Madison took those 212, squeezed them down to about 20-odd amendments, and then eventually to 12. Initially, there were to be 12 proposed amendments. The content was changed many times over.
So the First Amendment was actually the Third Amendment. Is that correct? In the original way he had structured it was the Third Amendment.
It was. The order of the amendments has no meaning whatsoever.
And so the first 10 of those we call the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And right now we're going to, before we run out of time, not that we're even close to running, but we want to talk about the Second Amendment, don't we?
Sure.
Fergus?
Yeah.
Just to make sure, folks, we are talking to Fergus Borderwick. This is our local, or at least our San Francisco, constitutional scholar this morning. We decided that with all the craziness going on in Washington and the state capitals, we should take a step back and see how we founded this whole thing. Obviously, I'm in a really different position. I'm Mr. Negative this morning on our founding document. Fergus, our expert, and of course, our co-hosts Klaus and Steve, are more in the flowery, positive, wonderful springtime side. I think the document may well have run its course. There are people here who want to change it very badly. people here, meaning in the United States, they want to have a constitutional convention. These are people with money. These are Olga. These are the Koch brothers. These are Adelsons. These are the people running everything. The corporate people want to have a constitutional convention to change it. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but first we're going to talk about Fergus and the Second Amendment.
Okay, well, you might imagine, given how large the Second Amendment looms in the thinking of a lot of Americans today, particularly those who want to defend their desire to own as many guns as possible and shoot them off as much as possible. And to put guns in every corner of the United States, including the hands of people who shouldn't be anywhere near weapons. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but you get where I'm coming from on this issue. You would think that something that looms so large for present-day Americans must have loomed large for those crafting the amendments. Not so. They regarded it as of almost no significance at all. And I've read the debates. I recommend anybody who's getting annoyed by what I'm saying here to go. You can read these debates. They're all on record. The debates in the first Congress, and see what was actually said about what we now call the second.
They're online, Ferguson.
They're in print. Okay. They're in print. Okay. All the papers of the first federal Congress.
So you can actually go back and see the context of what they were talking about, the Second Amendment.
Yes.
And what were they trying to do with the Second Amendment?
They weren't trying to do very much at all. It was kind of a collective shrug, frankly. There was no discussion whatsoever of this as a fundamental human right at all. What was the context? To understand the Second Amendment, you have to understand context. What else was going on while they were debating the Second Amendment? They were debating 10 different kinds of issues all at the same time. They were debating a militia bill.
Ah.
A militia bill. That's to say, nobody really wanted a standing army. Americans, standing army meant British soldiers squatting in your house, harassing your wife and daughter, eating your food, and generally annoying you. They didn't want a standing army. So the United States was going to be defended by militia, Minutemen, so to speak, who would be trained and then would be called up.
National Guard.
Yeah, essentially the forerunner of the National Guard. That meant that you needed a system. Who was going to be eligible? How were men going to be trained? How were they going to be called up? There was far more time given to discussing that than to the Second Amendment. But to have a militia that could be reliable, every man was expected to have a gun in his house. Okay. And that was the context in which the Second Amendment was passed. I've read all the letters that were written to Congress at the time regarding the amendments. There are about three that bear on guns.
And in some of your writings, you have several different versions of the Second Amendment that are written at different points.
Every amendment.
Some of them emphasized more. Militia was really emphasized in a stronger way in some of the early versions. Some of them start with a militia being necessary, and then et cetera, et cetera.
This was not subtle. There was no subtlety to this amendment at all. There's no mystery in the amendment, except that it's badly written. It is badly written. It's badly worded because we can still be sitting here 200-odd years later debating what they actually meant. And it's perfectly clear, if you know the history and the context, that they were talking about guns that would be handled by people who belonged to a militia. On the other hand, it was also assumed that, a lot of people live in a rural frontier society. Of course, they have guns in the house. They shoot rabbits. They shoot deer. They feed themselves, of course. That what you would today call sporting, I suppose, was kind of a given. Nobody imagined that they would ever that somebody who had a gun to shoot deer would not.
Well, how do we get from that militia and having a gun for sporting and self-protection, a gun, get to where I can have 100 AR-15s with 30-round clips, and on, you know. How do we get to that?
You get here by having an incredibly powerful, ruthless lobbying organization that backed by the arms industry that wants to sell a lot of guns and has convinced people that they're somehow threatened by reasonable legislation to control guns. This is not rocket science, frankly. The NRA and its backers have been shoving this down the throat of the country for a generation.
And the Second Amendment let them do that.
They have turned it into a wedge. But even the NRA in earlier incarnations, only some decades ago, supported reasonable gun control.
Right.
It hasn't always been as fanatic and violently defensive of guns as it is today.
So people are so led easily. So gun corporations, grabbed the NRA, made them lobbyists, and sold a heck of a lot of guns. And it's really that simple. So we have dozens, if not hundreds, of high school kids dying every year doing gun drills. And all that because they want to sell guns. It's just that some profit.
Yeah, though that same lobby is, of course, convinced a great many Americans who might otherwise be reasonable people that this has a deep constitutional root, and it has also scared them into thinking that they are under siege by somebody out there in American society who's going to assault them.
The thing that's convenient for gun manufacturers, the problem they have is that guns last a long time. You have a gun from World War One; it's still working. It still shoots. You don't really have to replace it. Yeah. So you have to convince people to buy more guns, and then you have to convince them to buy more ammunition. Or otherwise, everybody's going to sit around with the gun that they inherited from their grandfather or their father, and no money goes
to someday in some spasm of rationality, we could modify the Second Amendment.
Sure. Sure.
Right. Okay.
Sure.
Very good. That's good to know. And for all the people that are going to die between now and then, Fergus is sorry, and so is James Madison. Let's talk about some of the other amendments.
How about the
First Amendment?
Interestingly enough, what we now call the First, originally the Third Amendment, but anyway, now it's the First. We regard, when we speak of the Bill of Rights, putting aside for a moment the Second Amendment, I think most Americans would probably say the Bill of Rights is really the First Amendment. Many people don't even know what the other amendments are about, okay? But the first, we cherish, with good reason.
14 words, I believe, right?
Yeah. We deeply cherish the rights that are guaranteed in that First Amendment.
What are they?
Oh, freedom. We're talking about freedoms, basic freedoms, freedom of speech, press,
assembly,
and so on.
A religion.
How did this come to be? Okay. Oddly enough, there was a fair bit of debate over not the content of this amendment, or frankly, the content of any of the amendments, but rather whether there should be any at all. The real debate was whether amending the Constitution would weaken it because it was new, as Madison said, it was new, frail, untested. Do we want to risk changing anything now?
But it did just the opposite. It strengthened it to a point where I believe it made it last as long as it's lasted.
Yes.
So why did they go to the First Amendment? Did they think that was included? I know the language is not in the Constitution at all. Right. There's some language in the Declaration of Independence, which is sort of similar. But there's nothing in the Constitution about these freedoms to assemble. Remember, folks, it says peacefully assemble. It doesn't say you get to riot and try to overthrow the government and bring your guns and scare people. It says peacefully assemble. So why did they think that was necessary?
Well, I would say most didn't think it was necessary. It was a political compromise because anti-federalists wanted this. That's to say, those who feared a strong central government or hated the idea of a strong central government imagined the British crown. Remember, this is only a few years after the Revolutionary War. Oh. The people who are sitting in the First Congress, the people who sat in the Constitutional Convention, had been through the Revolution. And they remembered high-handed authoritarian British governors, military governors, denying them these rather simple simple rights and customs of North America, North American British, which they. So they equated a strong central government with the British crown. You know, they're not looking 200 years in the future.
So that's why the Constitution is so defensive about government power, and why they had started out with such a weak presidency, and over decades and decades and decades, they realized that's not going to work, and you have to have a strong presidency. They realized a lot of things, but the Constitution was written a long time ago, and. How would you interpret the Constitution? Because out here we hear a lot of originalists who say they're literalist about it, and they're projecting onto our Constitution their ideas about the Bible, inerrancy, that the Constitution can never make a mistake and never do anything wrong, and it's perfect. And when you look at the document, you know, there's flaws and things could be better written here and there. It is a great document anyway, because a great documents have flaws.
Well, and it was written for an agrarian society, right? It wasn't written for an industrialized society where a center of power is much more important than in agriculture.
Nobody at the time expected it to remain unchanged. They were not fundamentalists. They were certainly not religious fundamentalists. I mean, religion has permeated the thinking of an awful lot of Americans in recent times, so that the fundamentalist attitude has become applied to politics in a way that it certainly wasn't in the founding. There were no originalists at the origin. None. Not one.
What does that mean?
What I mean is today, of course, there are judicial originalists who think that the Constitution can only...
Gee, what is that sound?
Keep going.
That the Constitution can only be interpreted precisely in this as it was at the origin.
Right.
Well, none of them thought that way at the origin.
They all thought it would be. Yeah.
No. It's a compendium of political compromises. Mm. That's what it is, and that's why they put the process of amendment into it. Because they knew it was going to be changed. They knew it would have to adapt. James Madison himself said more than once, well, this is for now. Let's see how it works.
Yeah.
And you couldn't put in plainer language.
So, Fergus, what are we supposed to do? Okay, so we have this making sausage in the 1700s, and we come up with this Constitution. Then we come up with amendments, several Bill of Rights, 10 amendments, and a few others. Here it is, 2019, and we're in a hell of a fix, man.
Well, look, I think the worst thing we could possibly do is hold a new constitutional convention.
Yes, sir.
I think it would be a disaster.
Well, the pressure for that is huge.
I think it would, in some quarters, this is not going to happen, in my opinion. This is politically
not going to happen. Okay, you heard it here on Democratic Perspective by our expert. There's going to be no constitution. From your mouth to God's ear, young man.
We interviewed an expert years ago, and he said the time to have a constitutional convention is when there's a huge consensus to do something. Let's get rid of slavery. Let's have a strong. But to have it when the society couldn't be more divisive would be extraordinarily destructive. So a constitutional convention is something you have when you have broad agreement. The people that Mike's talking about pushing a constitution want to undo a lot of what we like about the constitution. And that's why they want to hold a convention. But holding a convention when there's this huge battle is not the right time to hold a constitution. I thought that was a good point.
Plus, I think it's unrealistic because it's hard to imagine that three-quarters of the states would accept the new constitution. Mm-hmm. There's another question.
They had 34 states, Klaus. They were only four states away with Republican congresses, Republican legislatures. Now, the trend has reversed because the game has been called, but they had no intention of consensus. They were going to get the 38 states and ram it down our throats.
That's true.
May I say that? I agree with what you're saying, Steve. I think idealistic people on the left have failed to realize that what the consequences of a new constitutional would be. I mean, there are people on the left who think it would be a great idea. We can remedy all these imbalances in the Constitution. Let's all get together. But these folks are delusional.
I agree.
They're absolutely delusional because they do not speak for the bulk of where the power lies in the United States.
There's a lot of bad thinking on the left as well as the right, and that is one issue where I agree with you completely, that the people on the left and who think this would be a good thing with this divided, ferociously divided society, what would you come up with? You would come up with, I don't know.
You would come up with a very right-wing oriented document that would that neither the public nor most of the states would really swallow.
One of the reasons I'm asking our constitutional speaker this morning about the constitutional convention is that the prospect of a new civil war, that the right is getting so good at this, they are blaming the left for all the things that the right are doing now, totalitarianism, authoritarianism, and that they are somehow blaming the whining and the complaint and the protest and the resistance of the left that's making them be more authoritarian, and that somehow out of this is going to come a civil war.
Well, I think it would be a mistake to become too persuaded that the irrational fanaticism of the most right-wing interests in this country and spokesmen are – have as much sway as they think they have.
Mm-hmm.
I hear these arguments, but this is a centrist country. It's center right, frankly, in this day and age. It's a center right country, whether we like it or not. This is the way people have been voting.
So we're all Clinton and Biden Democrats.
We're not all. But no. But
it was a joke.
Yeah. But by and large, I think Americans in this era are center-right, and they are not fanatic. The screeching loudness of right-wing talk radio and the propaganda machine that's Fox News and so on, I think has unfortunately influenced the casual thinking of a lot of people who don't think very hard about politics.
That's true.
That's true. Who don't have a clue as to how the system actually works, much less how Congress works. People who often protest that they are great patriots.
I agree completely. We have so many people with so many opinions who really don't know the facts and don't seem to care what the facts are. They don't want to know how the Constitution was actually formed. They want to enforce their idea that has some sort of emotional meaning to them. They don't really want to know what happened and why it happened. They don't want the facts. They don't want the history. They just want to wave this thing around.
I wanted to ask Ferguson another question that has always fascinated me. When the amendments were written, especially the First Amendment, I think the assumption was that it would apply only to the federal government. But since then, you know, that Bill of Rights, and especially the first one, has been applied to the states as well. And when and how did that happen, that it became not just a federal mandate, but, you know, went down to the local level as well?
Yeah, well, that's thanks to the three great post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which guaranteed civil rights and gave the federal government, along with some other legislation of the time, which is less well-known, the authority to enforce civil rights everywhere within the states. Now, that unfortunately went into abeyance later in the 19th century and wasn't really restored until the civil rights era of the 1950s onward. Okay.
But a lot of what we know of America is those amendments, right? They helped create the modern America. Those were extraordinarily significant amendments to our Constitution.
Those amendments gave real force to the First Amendment.
Right.
The First Amendment
for all Americans.
Yes, for all Americans. But the First Amendment did not have a lot of impact. In fact, nor did the Bill of Rights generally. It wasn't really until the 20th century that the Bill of Rights became elevated to the status in which we hold it today. It's quite it. There's a whole other history there, which we don't have time to go into, I think, of why, beginning primarily in the 1930s, as a counter to the totalitarian ideologies that were pervading Europe, the United States began Americans, Franklin Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt uh-huh. for this primarily, went back and began looking at some of these founding documents and helping uh-huh. create our present-day ideology of freedom as a counter to European totalitarianism.
So let's take that in our last couple of minutes with our constitutional expert, Fergus Bodewijk, from San Francisco, California. What about the Constitution what should we be talking about now regarding the Constitution in 2019? What conversation should we be having?
Well, okay. Look, if you were to say, I'm going to turn your question around slightly and say, is there a real problem with anything in the Constitution
okay, yeah,
that we've got to address?
Saying.
And I would say, there is no discussion of this, incidentally, that the worst imbalance in American government and politics that was created by the Constitution is ensuring that every state still receives only two senators. There was an imbalance at the beginning. Of course, Virginia was much more populous than Rhode Island. Absolutely, they knew that. And that's why there's the House of Representatives as well as the Senate.
Right.
That's why we have these two bodies that were elected differently. Okay, but the population disparity has ballooned. California has two senators. Wyoming.
So does Montana.
Well, Klaus, I know. Montana should probably have more than two.
Yeah, they're lucky.
Better Montana patriot.
The Montana exception for Klaus.
Yeah, we'll write that in.
Yes, well, but that's right. The disparity in population has gone so it's astronomical, and the number of people that represented in Wyoming, which I think almost has about 500,000 people, compared to what California has, 36 million people, they have the same representation.
And
that's pretty deadly toward changing the Constitution and also convincing people to participate in American government.
In the 3 minutes that we have left, I want to make sure that we get a chance for Fergus to talk about his website and some of the books that that he's written that are very interesting. That it's history, but it reads like fiction. It's easy reading. It's not a school textbook.
Your book, The First Congress, written in 2017. I love this kind of stuff. Early Christianity, and early America. What's your website?
It's Fergus Border, www.fergusbordewijk.com, okay. But I better spell my name.
Go ahead.
Yes,
it's
sir.
Fergus Bordewijk, Bordewich.
Wich.
Name of some of your other books, because I know you've written, we've got 1 minute. Is that it? Yeah.
Okay, so we want to make sure we get you to, Mark Kelly's coming to town, and that's a big deal. Astronaut Mark Kelly is running for Senate. He is coming to town May 15th and 16th. May 16th, he'll be at the
Heartland Cafe.
Heartland Cafe. Democrats are hosting him at the Heartland Cafe.
What time, Mike?
You might want to look up the time.
8 o'clock, as always. It's every door breakfast.
8 o'clock.
Will they be serving breakfast?
We'll be serving breakfast.
Okay.
There's also a little thing. Steve Segner's. You might want to check that out. Find this and all our shows at vbid.org, Verde Valley Independent Democrats.org. Thanks, folks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.